Good afternoon, and thank you for joining today's webinar, Ombudsman and Emergency Preparedness and Response. My name is Aaliyah Murphy, and I am the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program and Policy Associate here at the National Long-Term Care Ombudsman Resource Center, or NORC for short. We are going to cover a lot of material today in the next 90 minutes, so I would like to review a few housekeeping tips before we begin. During the webinar, all lines are muted. If you have a question, please post your question in the chat feature on the left side of your screen. We will keep track of the incoming questions and do our best to respond during the open discussion portion of today's webinar. When it is time for the question and answer period, we will ask you to raise your hand and we'll tell you how to unmute your line before speaking. Also, as you may have heard a moment ago, this webinar is being recorded and will be uploaded to the NORC website in the near future. So let's get started. In 2012, NORC received a supplemental grant from the Administration on Aging to develop model practices, resources, materials, and training for long-term care ombudsman programs around the issue of emergency preparedness. Through this project, NORC is developing information, resources, and best practice tips for state and local long-term care ombudsman programs that will help them be prepared for and respond to an emergency or disaster. Maria Green, who is a consultant with NORC, has been the lead on this project and will be leading the presentation today. Maria?
Thank you, Aaliyah. Welcome, everyone, and we're glad that you have joined us. According to Time Magazine, June 3, 2013 issue, the residents of Moore, Oklahoma had exactly 16 minutes to respond to the tornado emergency alert. On average, the U.S. public alert warning systems average 14 minutes for a tornado, 18 minutes for a severe thunderstorm, and 64 minutes for a flash flood, and 36 hours for a hurricane. These are just a few examples of how little time you and long-term care staff and residents may have to react to emergencies. Experts agree that emergency planning practice of the drills will help you to overcome the fear of an emergency. As Aaliyah mentioned, with funding from the Administration of Community Living, Administration on Aging, NORC conducted a state of readiness survey of long-term care ombudsman programs in the fall of 2012. You can see the survey response totals for both the state and long-term care ombudsman programs. The phone interviews were conducted with state ombudsmen and local ombudsmen based on information provided in the electronic survey. The focus areas that we're going to cover today include coordination with emergency management agencies, ombudsman training, communication, clearinghouse of information, and creative ideas. We will be using emergency management agencies as one of the primary examples of organizations to coordinate emergency planning and response. Please remember, however, that in your region, your state, your region, or your local communities, your point of coordination for emergency planning and immediate response may be firemen, law enforcement, public health, volunteer emergency medical technicians, and others. This diagram is an example of local and regional partners that's in the blue circle that may work together for an emergency planning and response. Local ombudsmen are part of the aging network. Various members of the Area Agency on Aging may participate and provide assistance in emergency planning and act as second-level responders after the immediate danger has passed. The lighter diagram reflects an example of the partnerships that should exist between the state ombudsman and the state unit on aging, the State Emergency Management Agency, the Long-Term Care Facility Provider Association, and Regulatory Services, also known as licensure and certification. In addition, other state partners may include the state police, public health, National Guard, and the Army Corps of Engineers. If a state's governor requests assistance from the president and the president declares a federal disaster, then federal agencies such as the Department of Homeland Security, FEMA, the Department of Health and Human Services, Public Health, CMS, and the Administration for Community Living will be called into action. Things that you can do as a state and local ombudsman is to ask the following: to serve on the state, regional, or local emergency management agency coordinating group and the public health coordinating council. You can attend the emergency management and public health trainings on emergency planning and response. Volunteer to serve in the operations center during emergencies as a long-term care specialist. And you can explain the long-term care program over and over and over. Not many of our partners are aware of the Ombudsman program, so it will take a lot of education and explanations. And take some effort on your part to learn the language, the acronyms, and the protocol of all the other partners. According to the State of Readiness Survey, it appears that training specifically for ombudsmen on emergency preparedness and response is infrequent or non-existent in the majority of states and local programs responding to this survey. So these are some tips for including emergency preparedness and training for your ombudsman. Add a component of emergency planning and response into new ombudsman worker training. Schedule at least once a year training on emergency preparedness in the most cost-effective training manner, such as a webinar, e-learning web modules, and in-person trainings. And provide written emergency preparedness information during weather-related awareness months. For instance, you might not know it, but this is the National Hurricane Preparedness Week for 2013. The dates are actually May 26th through June the 1st. You can get any of this kind of information that you can then copy and disseminate to everyone available through the National Weather Service. I will share with you now that we have some excellent best practice models available through the NORC website, and at the end of today's webinar, we'll share that link and the information with you. But I want to, at this time, go ahead and share two state examples of best practice models that include the emergency preparedness training done by North Carolina and the Oklahoma Long-Term Care Ombudsman programs. The North Carolina program coordinates with the Department of Public Safety, the Divisions of Health Services Regulation, and emergency management to provide annual, regional, and local trainings on emergency preparedness and disaster response. Attendees at the trainings include the ombudsman, long-term care facility staff, family care homes, adult care homes, mental health facilities, and the volunteer firemen, EMTs, and ombudsmen. Facilities bring their emergency preparedness plans and work to improve them during the training. Afterwards, the county emergency staff schedule dates with the facilities to actually go on site and walk through the plans. In Oklahoma, the Oklahoma Ombudsman Office, they require their local ombudsman to take the Mathers Lifeways Prepare training. The title of that training is Prepare, and it's all in caps if you want to look for it on the website. This training is a disaster preparedness webinar series, workshops, and toolkits that teaches long-term care facilities how to manage the natural disasters and other public health emergencies. The State Ombudsman Office provides the prepare training to newly hired ombudsmen and their AAA staff. When students go through the training, they in turn agree to train others. I'm going to share now about communications, and I think that George Shaw says it best. The single biggest problem in communication is the illusion that it has taken place. In order to decrease any illusions, it is best to plan how you will communicate with others before the next disaster. Decide how communications will take place between your office and the other partners. In your communication loop, be sure to include the State Unit on Aging, the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman, the AAA, employers, and the Ombudsman staff. Advanced planning and education about the role of Ombudsman post-disaster is very important for everyone to understand. You are first and foremost the advocate for residents. That responsibility does not change regardless of the immediate crisis. It's my pleasure to introduce you to Ms. Karen Jones. She is a director and program manager for a long-term care ombudsman program in California. And I'll ask Karen now if she'll join us and share her experiences and communication practices.
Hi, this is Karen. Can everyone hear me? Maria, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. Can't tell on these, you know, webinars. Welcome, everybody. My name is Karen Jones, and I'm the coordinator for San Luis Obispo County, California Ombudsman Program. It's a local program. And I want to start by giving a kind of a quick introduction to my county, for those of you not familiar with California. And I am fortunate to live in the best part of the nation, particularly California. And since this is a webinar with muted phone lines, you guys don't get to argue with me about my opinion. We have about 220,000 people who live in this county. It's located just about halfway between Los Angeles and San Francisco, just a little bit north of Santa Barbara. We share a border with them. The San Luis County is divided kind of into four regions. We have the South County area, the coastal areas. We have the North County, which is up a grade, which is sort of like a giant brick wall. Nobody from South County wants to go up, and nobody from North County wants to come down. And then we have the city of San Luis, which is right in the middle. And Oprah Winfrey says that we're the happiest place on earth. I'm sure there were people who beg to differ occasionally, but that's kind of how it is here. We're also the first place in the area in the nation to ban cigarette smoking in bars, restaurants, businesses, and public areas. So if you have that in your area, you can thank us. We are the ones who started that. We have a lot of miles of beaches and coastlines facing in all different directions, and we have Hearst Castle here. Most people here are polite. We hardly ever honk our horns at each other unless somebody's actually going to really ram us with their car for some reason. And our commuting times here are based on how long it takes you to get somewhere, not based on what traffic is doing, which you can't do that in Los Angeles. You have to figure out what the traffic's doing. So we think it's a bit of paradise. we don't have snow here or hurricanes or tornadoes, which we're very happy for. But we are at risk for the usual stuff, flooding and mudslides, earthquakes, chemical spills. We don't have heavy industry that creates a lot of chemicals here, but we have a lot of transport on major highway and train, so that would be likely where a chemical spill would come from. Terrorism's a concern for everybody, but we don't have a lot of targets here other than the nuclear power plant. And, of course, utility outages and fires are a big problem here in California, particularly this year. Fires are not going to be good. We had a lot of rain early and then nothing, so everything's dry. We are one of the rare areas in the nation that has a nuclear power plant. Somebody decided to build it on the most pristine part of our coast. It's beautiful, but there's a power plant sitting in the middle of it. It has helped us tremendously with our disaster planning because the Nuclear Regulatory Commission requires the county to have really detailed plans for handling an emergency at the plant. However, I wouldn't recommend to any of you that you lobby your county or your area to get this nuclear power plant just so you have better emergency planning. There's probably better ways to go about that. Just a little bit of our histories. Prior to Hurricane Katrina, our ombudsman program was pretty much shunned by the local disaster planners. They didn't really feel there was a need to have ombudsman part of it, and I think when I talked to them, they could have patted me on the head and said, good puppy, go away. That probably would have happened. Basically, we are told that care facilities have to have their own disaster plans, and they are absolutely on their own in a disaster. There would be no resources for them from the county or any disaster planners. After Katrina, when a lot of people with that kind of thinking started getting fired from pretty far up in the food chains for leaving care facilities on their own, we became really popular. The Ombudsman Program, we actually approached them again, the disaster planners, and said, now can we talk? And they really wanted to talk to us. we've since then been included in the disaster plans. We have a seat at the emergency table, and facilities have a lot of support in a disaster. And I just want to say how grateful I am to the people who suffered in Katrina, who allowed us to learn a lot from their tragedy. And it's really because of them that 3,000 people who live in care facilities in this county have a really good chance of surviving a disaster. Without Katrina, we would not be where we are today. So going to the slides, the first thing I wanted to talk about was phone numbers. And you can see on the slide there's a lot of contact people that you want to talk with, but you want to make sure you have backup phone numbers for everyone, not just, you know, their work number, the usual phone number, but you need to get a cell phone number, a home phone number, and you need to get it from also the second in line person. You know, if the manager of whoever it is that you need to talk to isn't available and they're the only one you have a phone number for, you may be out of luck getting help from them. So try to get at least one or two numbers down the line for people you might need to talk to at the time of that specific incident. You also want to make sure that for each agency and organization that you get the information from, you know, maybe people who might be on it at night, like a night manager, particularly for facilities. Also with vendors, you want to think about kind of emergency contact for vendors that you wouldn't normally think of. For instance, one of the easiest ways to help people or facilities in a disaster is to have, you know, a U-Haul truck pull everyone's equipment behind them. You can load a lot of people into a bus if they don't need to stay in their wheelchairs, but you have to bring the wheelchairs, or wherever you get them to, they won't be able to get around. So bringing wheelchairs and a U-Haul behind the bus is really helpful. But if it's after hours and you can't reach the U-Haul company manager or whatever, transportation manager, it won't matter. You won't be able to get those vehicles. So having those kind of contacts really helps. Same with like a bottled water provider. Someone who can bring you giant vats of water quickly could be really helpful. Another thing to keep in mind along with all this is about your power cords for your cell phones or tablets. Also, of course, for laptops. So we usually keep those with our laptops. Most of us keep our power cords for those items at home, and we charge those devices at night, and then we bring them back to work with us and around town, and then at night we recharge them again. Well, during an emergency, if you can't get home, those devices are going to become useless really quickly, and you may or may not be able to get to your local electronics store to get new chargers. So a car charger could be an alternative, but it's only going to be an alternative if you have access to your car where the charger is, and if gas is in short supply, it may not be the best way to use your gas to charge your phone or your tablet, so make sure you have an extra power cord in your disaster kit. You'll also want to keep what we call dead trees really handy, and that would be paper backup. You know, it's so convenient with electronic age not to have a lot of paper around, although if you saw my desk right now, you would laugh that I even say that because I think there's a desk under here somewhere. Got to be. Someone's got to hold up all this paper. Anyway, you want to have a, you know, I keep a binder in my car, or actually it's with me pretty much all the time. It's got phone numbers and addresses, facility lists, national list of state ombudsmen, rosters of local California ombudsman programs, licensing agency locations and phone numbers, kind of every phone number or contact information I may need. I have a copy of that on paper, and I try to keep it updated. I happen to use Outlook. I print off my contact list from Outlook about twice a year if I do a lot of updates to it. And I keep a copy of that also in case I can't get to my computer. A lot of the phone numbers I like to have are in Outlook, but if I can't get to it, I need to figure out where those numbers are going to be. If every electronic device just isn't available for some reason, it won't stop what I can do because I have it in backup on paper. So it's not hard to do. It doesn't take long to prepare it, but having a binder with all that information is really helpful in a disaster. Another option thing to consider if you use a laptop or a tablet device, it doesn't work so good on, I think, small, you know, smartphones because the screen's too small. But on the tablet, you can get an app for remote access to your office computer. And on the laptop, there's some through Windows, if you use Windows-based computers, you can get remote access to your desktop. And that will give you access to your computer wherever you are, as long as you have internet service, of course. At our office, we're a pretty small system, so we also have a backup system, and we use Carbonite. We only have 3 staff persons, and we have 4 computers, and we can handle it through Carbonite, so we don't have a server. But if you have a server, you might want to talk to your IT folks. But with the remote access and the backup system, even if my office computer is unavailable, you know, power's out, it's underwater, fire, whatever, I can still access my entire computer, all my files, as long as I can get to an internet. On the next slide, we have, that's Diablo Canyon. You can see how pretty it is there. It's on a hillside, and I think the Sierra Club was part of deciding where to put it, and I still don't understand why it was put there, but gorgeous location. I've only been there once, but wow, wouldn't be bad to work there for all the radioactivity. Anyway, in regards to the phones, one of the most important things you can have is redundant and backup communication. You have backups to your backups to your backups in hopes that you don't need to get to your backups, but if you do, you can still communicate with the outside world a bit. So it's critical to have options. One of the things we've done in my office, in addition to some of the stuff we're going to talk about, is to get remote forwarding for our phone line. So we have a main phone number that you call into to reach us on a normal daily basis. And from anywhere I have a phone, either my cell phone, a landline, or our satellite phone, which I'll talk about, I can remotely forward our phone line to wherever I want it to go. I can send it to a landline, I can send it to my fax number, to my cell phone, or to our satellite phone, which would be prohibitively expensive. If you have a satellite phone, I don't recommend that. Of course, if you're using your cell phone to make calls out or to be available to everybody who is part of the disaster, you probably aren't going to want to forward your main phone line to that also. But it does give us an extra option to be able to at least answer our phones if we need to, particularly not immediately during a disaster, but after a disaster. There's a long period of time during the recovery that you're still sort of in disaster mode, but you got to answer your phone. So it gives us that option if we can't use our office. And that system is not at our office. It's a phone line thing, so it doesn't matter if my office is unavailable. I can still transfer my phone lines. So what we have here is we have what we call the Government Emergency Telecommunication System, which is GETS. In disaster planning, everyone likes acronyms. So I think Maria mentioned that you want to get to know the language of everybody. It's really important with disaster folks because they love, love, love acronyms, even more than ombudsman, because boy, do we love them too. The GETS card is free, and what that does is it gives us priority. So if there is any dial tone on any landline, if I use my GETS card, it's kind of like a calling card. You have to dial a special number, and then it will connect you to the number you want to talk to. I get priority if I use that card over everybody else who's trying to call everybody else. So when the phone lines get jammed up in a disaster, if I can get a dial tone even for a few moments, I'm going to get priority over the other people trying also to get a dial tone. That card is free. There's no charge for that. Another option we have, which is also on the slide, is the Wireless Priority Service. And what that service does is it provides the same type of priority, but it's on my cell phone. It does have a small fee. It's not much. I think it's a couple dollars a month. And that way, on my personal cell phone, if, say, I'm not in the office or away from a landline or if I'm happening to use it for a disaster, we can still have some priority and get communication out. And then over the next few months, we are going to be trying to get all of our ombudsmen. I have about 30 ombudsmen, and we're going to try to get cards for all of them. So throughout our county, we have our ombudsmen will be able to use priority. If I can't get 30 cards, I'm at least going to try to get as many as I can so that we can, have the best chance to get around to folks. We're going to try to spread those out around the county, so it won't be all like in San Luis. It'll be everywhere. Excuse me. I wanted to mention, after Katrina, a lot of folks, we were talking with different folks. I actually had an opportunity to talk with Linda Sadden, who was the former Louisiana State Ombudsman, and she was talking about what happened with communication. In Katrina, all forms of communication broke down, including radios and ham radios and, repeater stations. They all went down. The only thing that worked was the satellite phones, and, of course, because they're very expensive, it's hard to have a lot of those around. So what I did after talking with Linda is I spoke with our county health department to use disaster funds that they had available to provide satellite phones for both my office, we have one, and each of the 8 nursing homes in the county. So our nursing homes, which are our biggest long-term care providers, and myself, we all have satellite phones. So if everything else fails, at least we have those phones. The important thing if you do get satellite phones is to make sure that they get tested often and by a lot of staff. So not just one person in each organization knows how to use that satellite phone. If you have too many facilities that only have one person who can use it, you kind of have to hope the disaster happens when they're there. They're not hard to use, but it's kind of like international calling. There's an awful lot of numbers to dial, and you have to get them just right or you don't get anywhere. And, of course, they're very expensive. The minutes are about $1 a minute, and they go up pretty quick. You can really start to spend money in a disaster if that's your only communication. One of the other things we have in our county is ham radio operators. They're part of the county's disaster plan, so there's a lot of ham radio operators in the county. I happen to have two ombudsmen who are ham radio operators, so that is a backup to everything else. But, you know, in an earthquake or a certain kind of fire, we can lose the radio, the towers that promote that, so that's just one of our backups. One thing that didn't make it onto the PowerPoint slide that I wanted to mention is the need to have an old-fashioned, you know, kind of plug-into-the-wall phone available. The phone system in my office is based on electricity. It's, I don't know, star system, something like that. And the plugs in the wall are not normal plugs, that, you know, the old style. So because they pull more electricity or something, I don't know. It's not my area of expertise. But anyway, in a disaster, if the power is out, or just if the power is out for whatever reason, we can't use our phone system. We don't get a dial tone at all. So what we do have, though, is our fax line. Our fax machine won't work, but we can plug into the fax line just a regular old, you know, those old princess phones. You know, you pick them up and dial. They're just poke buttons, no electricity needed. So we can have one of those, or we have one of those that we can use in a disaster or in a short-term power outage. So I highly recommend having one of those in your office if you have any normal phone lines available to you so that you can continue to use a phone if you're in your office or bring it with you to a disaster site. And then I wanted to close my portion of the training by mentioning some kind of a non-communication issue, but a getting around issue. In San Luis Obispo County, what we've done is, if there's a disaster and you need to travel through a disaster area for some reason, it's likely the roads are going to be blocked with armed police or National Guard or somebody with a gun. You don't really want to mess with them too much, and it's hard to get through those systems. So they're going to be denying access to people. To be honest, I was told they did do that mostly because of looting and to keep people safe. My feeling is if you're there to help evacuate a care facility, grab a TV, you know, buy one, get one free. Help us evacuate and have the television. But they don't really find the humor in that, so I don't tell that to the disaster people too often. So if you do need to get into a disaster area, either to check a facility or to be a part of the disaster response, all of our staff, all of our ombudsmen and volunteers have we have disaster worker ID cards, so we can actually show the ID card and get into the disaster area as long as we're capable of being able to drive there. You know, if the roads are flooded or blocked or, you know, unpassable, of course we can't go. But if they're at all passable, then we can get through the checkpoints. All of our care facility staff also have these cards. Well, they have access to the cards. Many of our facilities have not actually distributed them at this point, which is a really big concern to us. But it's a really great method for making sure we can still do our work. We're not trying to be first responders, but what we've discovered when we call facilities after any kind of earthquake or fire or anything to check on them is we don't always get accurate information. You know, a lot of times, no matter what question we ask, they'll say, yes, ma'am, because they don't really know what we're asking. So we'll need to go out and actually check on the status of that facility and send somebody out to go see them. So not as a first responder. We're not trying to pretend that an ombudsman is a fireman or a policeman, but just so we can make sure that there's no unmet needs there and that things are being provided to those residents. If you're interested in the system, you can give me a call. My number is 805-785-0132, and I can get you some more information on the card system. And I do have to make an apology. I'm not going to be able to stay for the entire call. I have to get to another meeting. But I can always be reached at that same number, 805-785-0132, and I'll be happy to talk to anybody with questions that Maria or Leah can't answer later. However, I would caution you not to call until after the webinar ends, because otherwise you won't hear the other speakers. So thank you very much for listening, and have a great day, and hopefully you'll get some wonderful tools today.
Thank you so much, Karen. I really like, and I had asked her to mention about the identification cards, because that may not be unique just to her county, but I have not talked with other people around the country yet who have that much-needed, I think, identification card. In the emergency management world, people like ourselves, like ombudsmen, are considered second responders. So if you hear that lingo used in talking with emergency managers. They will know and kind of recognize that as somebody who works in social services or human services, or if you say, I'm the person that knows this nursing home the best and I can get in there and help them, even if they don't understand ombudsman, they would understand that you're someone there from county social services, for example, that are going to be there to help them out. We're going to talk next about the clearinghouse of information. You probably all remember when we were children and we played the gossip game. We would begin with a story and we would retell the story to the next person and then the next and the next until the last person retold a story, and it was a totally different story from the first story that was told. Well, that's kind of what happens times 10 in a crisis situation. Unless states have a defined clearinghouse of information, we may feel as if we're children again playing that gossip game over and over during a crisis. Now, I didn't come up with this title, clearinghouse of information. It's actually a term used and documents that you can find in the Department of Health and Human Services, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Survey and Certification. You'll see here on the slide the two documents that are referenced. One is done as planning checklist in 2007, and the other is a frequently asked questions document from 2011, where it references that we have a responsibility in each state to help track residents, patients if they're in acute care facility during any type of emergency or public health emergency also. And so that's keeping up with evacuations, tracking where people are evacuated to. Some states also keep information on which facilities in particular are sheltering in place, which means everybody's staying inside the facility to weather the event, no pun intended on the weathering the event. Okay, let's go to the next slide. And so this is what we know about clearinghouse of information. There is no template or format. So if you went from the East Coast to the West Coast, you're not going to see the same format out there that state agencies would use. CMS does not designate which state agency should manage the information, so it's going to vary in every state. It may vary by region or locality. What I'm finding in our research so far on behalf of NORC is that usually this tracking of information resides somewhere within the state emergency management agency or the licensure and certification agency. Those seem to be the two most common places that you might find this information. You may be asked as an ombudsman to provide information on facilities in your region, so that might be a common thing that you might would be asked to assist in doing during an emergency. I would also suggest that if your state does not have a clearinghouse of information or a protocol for at least keeping information on an Excel spreadsheet, that this is an excellent thing that you could advocate for. It's a great example of practicing systemic advocacy on behalf of long-term care residents. It can be very helpful, and usually when people get evacuated, they might go to one shelter, and then they may be moved to another long-term care facility. They may yet be moved again, so it can be challenging to keep up with family, to keep up with the residents, and then to keep the families informed. So I would recommend that you advocate for one if you do not have one in your state, or start posing the question at least, who manages this process? Your work as an ombudsman helping residents resolve their concerns and complaints is no different the day before or the day after the emergency. The type of residents' complaints may be more challenging and definitely unique to whatever type of emergency or disaster you've experienced in your area. Today we have asked John Sotillis, director of an Ohio Regional Ombudsman Program, to share with us his experiences. John?
I think I'm unmuted, right?
You're unmuted.
Okay. The a bit of background on our AAA, we cover four counties along the eastern edge of Ohio, bordering Pennsylvania, from Lake Erie down to areas along the Ohio River. There's 73 nursing facilities and approximately 60 assisted living facilities and adult group homes within that region. And we've run into situations where we've gotten involved in emergencies dealing with nursing facilities, and if we may call them disasters in a sense. And I wanted to touch on that real quickly. There's no real difference between a nursing home that has to be evacuated because of massive flooding in the area, or one that needs to be evacuated because a sprinkler had broke off and flooded the facility from that. Or in a case where we had is a pipes froze and water spread throughout the facility, and then during the reconstruction phase they discovered there was asbestos throughout the facility, which required some things. So sometimes when we look at disasters, we want to be careful not to think of the massive Katrina-like things, because I think there is a role in terms of ombudsman programs within other types of situations. And I just wanted to talk about a couple that we've been involved in. One actually involved a nursing home during severe downpours of rain. We don't have a lot of flood-prone areas, even with the Ohio River. At least there's no nursing homes that are generally affected or are affected by that situation. And even along Lake Erie, we don't have that type of situation with flooding. But over a period of several days, we had torrential downpours. And because of a sewer line backups or storm sewer drainage problems, the water backed up into a 57 residents were into a 100-bed facility, and 2 to 3 inches of water went flowing throughout the entire facility, resulting in the evacuation of all of those residents. We found out about it the morning after the evacuation, and I think as ombudsmen go, we decided to go in and see what was going on, and came to find not collapsed buildings, but shoes floating in residents' rooms. Residents' belongings were either soaked on the floors, or they were in some cases wrapped up in garbage bags and waiting to be transported to find out where all the residents went. So one of the things that we thought about was, well, how were these things, some of them were destroyed, television sets and clothing and all this other kind of stuff. How are you going to replace that if people are subsisting on a small personal needs allowance of $40 a month? And they're really not. So one of the first things we did, as well as determining where all the residents went and making an effort to follow up with the residents to the facilities to where they were transferred, but also how to address the issue of how to help put their lives back together. The facility was closed for a significant period of time in terms of reconstructing the floors and everything else that had to be fixed. And so one of the things that we thought about was, how do we find a source of funding to help the residents, get back on their feet or get their possessions replaced or whatever else? And, started making phone calls, really having no idea which way to go, and contacted the Medicaid folks and some of the emergency management folks, and all we could find out was that each county was allocated $25,000, of which most of it was already spoken for very, very quickly. Well, that didn't help at all. But then there was actually in the county a federal disaster declaration, which then brought up the idea of FEMA. And again, not knowing exactly what was involved there, but starting to ask questions and then talking to FEMA people on site, we found out that there was a grant program for individual households. And we had to walk through some bureaucratic definitions, and were able to determine that a resident in a nursing home would qualify for a grant from FEMA to help offset their losses. We got the paperwork together,
followed through with the nursing homes and their social workers and the facilities, and literally helped file 57 FEMA grant applications in a short period of time. It didn't take a long time. And as it turned out, each of the residents then received, it was $940 in terms of monies to replace their missing items. The point of that really was that going into something like this, we did not know exactly where the path was going to lead us. But just being aware of the needs of individual long-term care facility residents along the way, you just follow your instincts and you find things that can benefit them. The other part of what we have done over the years is we also look at weather-related emergencies when storms come through. And we're not talking about the huge tornadoes that can wipe out, you know, huge amounts of area, but storms that knock down power lines or snowstorms or ice storms. And what we find is that there are various areas throughout the state, but also throughout our PSA, that have more localized effects, including areas where nursing homes and group homes and assisted living facilities are affected. So one of the things that we do is we monitor the utility company's power outage map system, which identifies locations where there are significant power outages, and then we will follow up and we will call each of the facilities in those affected areas from our ombudsman staff and simply ask, do you have power, to kind of measure who is without power and who is on using generators. And once we have identified any facility that is currently using a generator, then we take a couple of steps to see what we can do to help. And let me address one thing on that. People sometimes think, well, you have a facility, it has an emergency plan, it has a generator, they're tested four times a year, everything's okay. But the reality is generators don't provide the same amount of power as the normal grid does. And we recently had a facility that was on a generator for about 24 hours. The facility had purchased the variation of those miner's lamps for their staff. We had a light illuminating, you know, from a helmet-like thing. And that's how they were doing personal care at night, because the power produced from the generator just wasn't enough to provide any illumination. So even in the case where there's a generator going, it doesn't mean that the quality of life for residents is not affected. So one of the things that we do is once we determine where the power outages are, we will contact several parties. We have contacted emergency management agencies to see whatever help that they can provide. We contact elected officials and let them know that here are the facilities in your jurisdiction that are having power outages. We will see what we can do, but we may need your help later, because they sometimes have a little bit more influence with other government entities. And then the other thing we do is we will contact, and sometimes it's difficult to get through during emergencies, the utility companies themselves. And then we will beg and plead and do whatever we can to have those facility addresses, those customers, prioritized in terms of getting their power back on. And we just simply feel, as ombudsmen in long-term care facilities, if you have 1,000 customers that are without power, somebody has to be number one and somebody has to be number 999, and we feel that it's important that the long-term care facilities, group homes, assisted living, or whatever, you know, go higher on the priority list, and our role as advocates is exactly that. And we've been fairly successful, you know, doing that type of activity in terms of seeing that facilities get the power trucks rolling in to get their needs taken care of. Time permitting, we also will follow up with residents that we've been involved with in the home setting, depending on where the locations are. For instance, the people with the MFP grants. We know there are our clients, our consumers who are getting home care services. We do make every effort to make sure that either in person or over the phone that they're they're okay through some of this type of activity.
So those are just a couple of the type of things that we locally, as ombudsmen, get involved in when there's weather-related emergencies or other things that, that may be considered disasters. Fortunately, I think in Ohio, that Beverly Lawbert, the state ombudsman, is very active even at the state level. In fact, is the co-lead for the Aging Network as part of the state emergency management agency when there are disasters affecting large portions of the state, and is working within the Emergency Operations Center. And as regional ombudsman, I think it is very important that we provide firsthand knowledge as to what the situation is, funneled through the state ombudsman, who then can interact at the higher levels of state government to make sure that the needs and situations involving the elderly are right at the forefront in those type of deliberations. Those are just a couple of stories.
John, this is Maria. Will you also share your office's idea about keeping the elected officials aware of the progress for facilities getting their utilities restored?
Yeah, we do that for a couple reasons. One is that, for instance, the electric companies are regulated by the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio. And sometimes if you're having difficulty in getting through to the utility company, especially after hours, and if people have tried to do that, and again, you know, sometimes we have an individual's number and sometimes we've had a cell phone number, but people change in different positions, so we're not as good as we should be in terms of keeping those internal contact numbers. But sometimes it's very important when a state elected official, a member of the Ohio House or a member of the Ohio Senate, can help us get in contact with, say, the Public Utilities Commission, which then can certainly get in contact with the utility companies. And it's just a matter of utilizing that as a resource. And at the same time, we want to stay in contact with the elected officials to let them know what's going on with their individual constituents as well. And that builds that relationship. And again, the ombudsman programs are funded by state and federal dollars, so it is important that we have the relationship with the elected officials. The other thing you talk about, relationship building, that is also something that our efforts to reach out and assist facilities during the weather emergencies and power outages is something that we focus on, is to not always to portray ombudsman offices as always being in an adversarial position. And we do get the initial, why are you calling us response. And our answer is, no, we're not playing gotcha to see what's going wrong. We're calling to see how we can help you. And it's part of our general belief and advocacy efforts. We do have a sign in our office that simply says, mount up and ride to the sound of the guns. So if there's some situation where we may be able to help out and deal with long-term care facility residents, we're simply going to do that. We're not first responders in our involvement, and I don't think we would be involved in the first response situation in these types of situations. But
John,
soon thereafter, we do whatever we can.
John, thank you very much. I really applaud the creative work of John and his staff there in Ohio, as I'm sure many of you or all of you on the phone have used a lot of creative thinking to resolve probably some unique concerns. And for instance, like with the FEMA reimbursement for the residents that John was referring to, he didn't wait for FEMA to say, can you do this? Because I don't think it's a normal function of FEMA to encourage people to not go to the disaster recovery center on site to fill out the paperwork. But as ombudsman, you can advocate that you would help the residents complete the paperwork where they are, whether they've been evacuated or if they're sheltered in place for whatever reason, and they have a legitimate right to file claims also when they have lost possession. So John and Karen both, thank you so much for sharing your creative ideas and ways that you've operated. Today, in a short period of time, we've covered coordination not only with emergency management agencies, but a lot of other agencies, both at the federal, state, regional, and your local area. We've covered ideas and ways that you could do ombudsman training to have your ombudsman volunteers and paid staff be more aware of emergency preparedness. We've covered some real basics on communication and how to have a lot of backup plans for communication, including those paper copies. We've talked about the need to advocate, if you don't have one already, for a clearinghouse of information in your state. That's where everybody would keep track of where people have been evacuated to. And then we've talked some about the creative ideas and that extra burst of energy it might take on your part to think of ways to help residents resolve problems. And what we'd like to do now, Aaliyah, if you'll assist with this, is open it up to any questions from the audience members, any additional thoughts, ideas, or questions that they might have.
Sure. So just a reminder to everyone that if you want to ask a question or make a comment, please either type it into the chat feature at the bottom left of your screen or raise your hand and we will call on you and let you know how to unmute your line.
While we're waiting for people to do that or to write their chat questions, I'll go ahead to the last slide, which is the link for all of the best practice and the tip sheets that you'll find at the National Long-Term Care Ombudsman Resource Center website.
Again, to ask a question, just either type it into the chat feature or you can raise your hand. Okay, Maria, we have a question from Lourdes Lopez. She asks, how can we check if we have a local emergency preparedness and plan in their area?
I would start, Ms. Lopez, by checking with your, it would be fairly simple to check with your county public health office and ask them about the emergency management agency if you're not sure of that name, because I know public health is probably available and you can locate it there. You can also ask local law enforcement, firemen, almost all of those public health, law enforcement, firemen, are going to be active members of their emergency management council or coordinating group. It may have different, go by different names in your area, but I think any of those partners would be able to tell you who organizes it and when the next meetings will be.
Okay, well, if we don't have any more questions, I just want to say thank you to Maria, Karen, and John again for that very informative presentation. As I said before, we will be posting the recording of today's webinar along with the call materials to the NORC website in the next couple of days. We'll send out an email and post an announcement on our homepage once they are up, so be on the lookout for that. Thank you again to everyone for joining us today, and hope you all have a great afternoon.
Thank you. Please stand by.